It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a theater director who stages ancient Greek tragedies as a way to help veterans and others overcome PTSD. First, what's the best way to teach Wisconsin students in an increasingly multilingual environment? Tonight, Madison's school board is expected to vote on a new proposal for teaching students whose native language is not English. Also known as English language learners, these students now make up around 1 in 4 students in Madison Public Schools. Most of them speak Spanish, with a growing number of Hmong speakers, among others. The plan, which includes an immersion program that would mix English and Spanish speakers in a single classroom with the aim of proficiency in both languages for all the students, has seen pushback in some neighborhoods. The question of how best to teach English language learners is one that reaches across the state. Wisconsin's Hispanic population has been growing in every county, with some of the largest growth in rural areas. While some Hispanics may be fully bilingual or speak English as their first language, many also learn English at school. Here with us now to talk about Madison's plan is Sylvia Romero-Johnson, Executive Director of the Office of Multilingual and Global Education at Madison Metropolitan Schools. Sylvia, hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And Salvador Carranza is with us. He's President of the Latino Education Council. Salvador, thank you as well.
Oh, thank you for having us. Thank you very much.
Well, Sylvia, to start with, what are some of the different languages spoken in Madison schools?
Yes, we have students who are enrolled in our school districts, and we have almost 100 languages or more. And the majority of the students speak Spanish as their first language at home, approximately 58% of all the students. Then we have the next group of languages are Hmong, Arabic is growing, Mandinka, Korean, Mandarin, etc., etc.
And how has that picture been changing, say, over the last 10 years or so?
Yes, over the last 10 years, it has basically doubled the number of students the percentage of students who have been enrolled in the district has virtually doubled from 14% to now approximately 27%. That's last school year's demographic information that we have. So we see this in many of our schools. Some schools have approximately 50% of their student enrollment is made up of English language learners. Others are, you know, different percentages.
And Salvador, you recently wrote a piece about English language learners and how the school is meeting their needs, might not be meeting their needs, and how that all fits into state and federal law. What's the basic philosophy we should keep in mind when it comes to this kind of education?
Well, part of it is federal law requires that there are certain support systems in place for English language learners, regardless of the language. Obviously, if you come here and you don't speak English, before you can fully understand English and be proficient to be able to learn, you need to have some support in your language. That's just normal and logical. Federal law requires that. Unfortunately, not all our schools or school districts in the state provide the adequate level of support for these students. Some don't provide any support. In our school districts, we are fortunate in Madison that we have had some schools and some areas that do support English language learners. For example, we do a language immersion programs. But that depends on where you live in the city. And there's no equal access to everybody. So it's a matter of opportunity as well. So that is the reason that the LL plan, part of it is to comply with federal law and state law. But part of it is also to give a choice and opportunity to families and children that want to also keep their language and become proficient, as you mentioned at the beginning, in both their language and English by the time they graduate, to have that opportunity.
Well, Salvador mentioned, Sylvia, this new plan. It's coming up at a meeting tonight. So what would change in this plan that's going to be proposed to the Madison School Board here?
Yes, so there are several changes that we're proposing. One of them is greater communication with parents. We know because parents have told us, we have held a number of informational sessions with parents, and they have told us that they do not necessarily understand what services their students are receiving. So we have put a great emphasis on parent communication in all aspects of the services of English language learners, from the identification process, through the yearly assessments that English language learners have to take, through the the years when students are being monitored and then exited out of the program. We need to make sure that parents understand exactly what's going on at each step of the way. So that's one area. The other area is a number of monitoring, internal monitoring systems. So as a district, we need to do a better job to be continually monitoring how our students doing. Are they on track, for example, our high school students? Are they on track to graduation? Are they being enrolled in courses that lead to graduation and preparedness for college or career after high school? And then one critical aspect has been the issue of equitable access to bilingual education. Because we do have state statutes that mandate access to a bilingual bicultural program. We know that there's limited access in the district because currently we have only 7 schools that have offer a bilingual program. But we have English language learners whose home language is Spanish in virtually every school. So we need to move forward and provide that equitable access by making more programs available to students.
We're talking to Sylvia Romero-Johnson and Salvador Carranza about English language learners in the school, people learning English in part or in whole in public schools, an issue statewide, an issue in Madison tonight at a school board meeting as they prepare to vote on a plan to change the way that's done in this district. Salvador, I know there's been a lot of public hearings lately, some feedback. A concern, I imagine, from students whose parents aren't English language learners might be, is this taking resources away from our kids? Is this going to hurt the education for some kids while helping others?
Well, that's one of the misunderstandings. There's a lot of concerns that really don't have any real foundation. For example, English language learners, because the federal law requires that they get certain support, there's title money that they bring into the school district that they could support their learning as well and the support systems that can be put in place. So they are actually bringing funds into the district, additional funds that wouldn't be there if these English language learners weren't there. So that's one of the things. The second thing is that we need to make sure that if we are going to be equitable, and equitable means to every student what they need to succeed. These students need bilingual and support programs to be able to be successful. We need to find out if there's any other groups of students that are not in DLI programs or bilingual programs, or they choose not to. What can we do to equitably give them the opportunity for quality education? But that's a separate issue. It shouldn't be mingled with the issue that these students need the support. These students require the support by federal and state law, and we are not giving that support to all of them. So I think we have to separate. If there's legitimate concerns that are incidental to this plan being passed, they have to be dealt in a separate manner to really give everybody an equitable opportunity to meet their need where they are.
And Sylvia, I wanted to ask about the immersion program Salvador brought up earlier. So as I understand it, you might have a classroom where you have English speakers and Spanish speakers, and the idea is they both come out speaking both languages. Talk about how that works.
Mm-hmm. So the classroom composition is, like you said, approximately half of the class is made up of English language learners whose home language is Spanish. And the other half are all other learners because whether they are non-ELLs and they're English speakers at home, or they're even ELLs and speak other languages at home, they're also eligible for the program. So the program is really wide open to all students in the district. And the objectives are basically three: high levels of bilingualism, so being able to communicate, speaking and listening and understanding in two languages, in both social and academic context. And the second one is biliteracy, so being able to read and write, be able to do presentations, communicate, again, not just socially, but also about academic content, about math, about science, about social studies. So it's a different level of language that they're also developing in two languages. And then the third one is intercultural skills, meaning having the cultural skills to be able to address and live and negotiate with people from different cultural backgrounds. This is a critical skill that we have to have in this 21st century of global markets and global interconnection with people.
And Salvador, one thing I think you're getting at in the piece I mentioned was the idea that this isn't a burden or a problem to be solved, but an opportunity for Native English speakers and non-Native English speakers alike. Can you expand on that? How can we make that a plus for everybody involved?
Well, I think everybody understands nowadays, like you started the program. We're living in a global environment. More and more, speaking another language, understanding other cultures, and language is a vehicle for understanding other cultures, by the way, is extremely important. It's a skill that every one of our students in our school district should have the option. And I'm emphasizing option. It's a choice. There might be parents or families that might not want that choice for the children, and that is okay. But we shouldn't take that choice away from those families that do want it. That's why this plan will give that choice available to every family that does need it and those who would want to have it for their own children. So that is the key important point.
We're talking to Salvador Carranza. He's president of the Latino Education Council. Also with us, Sylvia Romero-Johnson, executive director of the Office of Multilingual and Global Education at Madison Metropolitan Schools. Talking about Madison's plan for teaching English language learners. There's a vote expected tonight from their school board there. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Whether you're a teacher, a student, or parent, how does your community teach English language learners? Do you think it's successful? What could improve? What do you think of what you've heard so far in Madison? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Sylvia Romero-Johnson, Executive Director of the Office of Multilingual and Global Education at Madison Metropolitan Schools, and Salvador Carranza, President of the Latino Education Council. We're talking about the Madison School District's plan for teaching English language learners, a statewide issue. It's on the school board's agenda there tonight. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you or your child an English language learner? What's going on at your schools? Are you a teacher or parent in a school district with a lot of students who are learning English as maybe their second language? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Michelle on the line in Kenosha. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say good luck. I think that Madison could sorely use this, and in Kenosha, this has been in existence for almost 20 years. This is the 19th year. All three of my kids went through a K-8 dual language Spanish-English immersion, and all three are fully bilingual in both languages.
Nice.
I just can't speak highly enough about this. And anybody in the state who's interested, there's so many resources. But good luck to those of you in Madison, and any child can benefit from this, whether they're native English speaker, native whatever, they can benefit from this type of education.
And Michelle, I wanted to ask, so your students learned Spanish as a second language in Kenosha schools?
Yes, they did. Yes, right. They did through a fairly unique, going through eighth grade. Most go through fifth. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to do AP Spanish and advanced Spanish right away in high school. Mm-hmm. And it's just a great cognitive benefit to all students. So if anybody wants to come to Kenosha and see how it's done, it's right there, and it's absolutely fantastic. So good luck to you guys.
Michelle, thank you so much for the call. And Salvador, as we've mentioned, this is a statewide issue. Are there a lot of programs like this with that dual language learning around the state?
Yes, there are several programs. I believe there's programs in Milwaukee. I believe there's programs in Waukesha as well.
Racine
mm-hmm. has a program, but it's not readily available to everyone. That is the issue. I mean, there's spots here and there, but they should be available to anybody who would have a choice to be able to have this great opportunity, both English language learners and English speakers.
Michelle, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. There's a parent there. That reminds me, Sylvia, I wanted to ask you about families. It's one thing for the kid in mm-hmm. a school to learn English. How about bringing the families on board so they can communicate with the teachers, understand the homework assignments, that kind
of
thing?
Yes. So families whose home language is not English currently have really great deal of trouble very often communicating with staff who are often not bilingual. We do make available in our district staff who we call bilingual resource specialists. So they're interpreters to help parents communicate with the school and school communicate with parents. But the beauty of these dual language immersion programs is that it increases the number of available staff where the classroom teacher is bilingual. Sometimes some of the principals are bilingual. So it lessens the requirement for that intermediary, and the parent can go directly to the people who are teaching their mm-hmm. kids, mm-hmm. directly to the principal, so that they don't have to always be in a position of, in a deficit position, but also can contribute directly to the school community.
We'll bring another caller in now. We've got John on the line in Cary, Illinois. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, thank you for taking the call. It's a very interesting topic. I'm a heritage speaker of Spanish, second generation. My mother came from Mexico. And my comment briefly as I can is it's not just if you think you know English, it's subtle cues like social cues and communication and behavior that the immigrant children might need help with. If that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely.
John, yeah, let's talk more about that. Thanks for the call, John. Salvador, what things would they need beyond the basic words and phrases?
A part of it, what he's talking about is feeling welcome in the school, feeling like they are valued. I think understanding those social cues and having somebody that understands where these kids are coming from the cultural perspective, being culturally competent, but not just culturally competent, which is a little bit passive, but culturally responsive to the kids and the families. That's extremely important. These programs are actually developed to address some of those issues for both English language learners and English speakers. That's why they're so valuable.
And at the level of this changing program, what would happen to tackle those sort of cultural issues and appreciation of the students that Salvador was talking about?
Yeah, so within the curriculum, we make sure that we include a curriculum that is culturally responsive to all of the different cultures. So not just the Latino mm-hmm. culture, but all cultures, because we need all students to understand that cultures have a lot in common, but also there are culture-specific expectations, and we want all students to be able to navigate what that is. So the other part that's important is as a bilingual program, it is a very, very important part for students to develop high levels of proficiency in English. Mm-hmm. So we often think about the minority target language because it is such an important part of the identity development for language minority students, but the other part of a bilingual program, of a well-implemented bilingual program, is making sure that all students reach high levels of proficiency in English and that they exit from the ELL services program.
Talking to Salvador Carranza and Sylvia Romero-Johnson about English language learners and how they're taught in schools. It's an issue in Madison with a vote in the school board tonight, an issue a lot of school districts around the state are working on as well. We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Richard on the line with us in Madison. Richard, hi.
Hi. I commend you people for doing what you're doing. I came from a small town in northeastern Wisconsin, and I didn't have a chance to learn a foreign language until I was a sophomore in high school, which is way too late.
Richard, thanks a lot for the
Thank
call.
You.
So I've heard
Thank
a lot, and I think Richard's alluding to the idea that the earlier the better when it comes to language learning. How early do the immersion programs start? What age, Sylvia?
We start with 5 years old, kindergarten, 5-year-old kindergarten, and it goes through eighth grade as a 50-50 model, meaning by the time the students get to eighth grade, half of the days in Spanish, half of the days in English. And then we do have a high school continuation program with classes that are at the proficiency level, so students can continue maintaining and developing both English and Spanish. But what's important is that we have the idea of a pathway. We have English language learners at this point who are not accessing courses at the high school level that are, for example, advanced learner courses or AP courses. But in this case, students who are in this dual language pathway would be able, by design, to be able to access high-level courses. So, which is, it puts English language learners in a completely different trajectory for advanced learning.
In our last couple of minutes or so, let's talk about outcomes. I assume that's what this is ultimately all about. What are you hoping for with this change in the program, Sylvia, to see when it comes to graduation rates, maybe college attendance, that kind of measurable thing?
Yes, we want to see students engaged in learning. We want to see students happy to go to school and learn. We want to see high levels of proficiency in both English and Spanish. We want to be able to see students attaining English language proficiency in a shorter period of time than we currently have, and certainly want to be able to see that translated into higher graduation rates that we currently have, and students being prepared to actually tackle and enroll in the pathways of their choice after high school graduation.
And Salvador, very briefly.
Just briefly, one thing that is extremely important that I'm talking about outcomes. The programs, to be successful, like any other program, have to be implemented with fidelity. If they're not implemented with fidelity, they're not going to be successful. And that's one thing that is not just passing the plan. It's not just saying we now have a plan. We have expanded DLI programs. We have expanded bilingual opportunities. He's saying, how are we going to implement them in the schools with fidelity, faithfully, so that we can get the outcomes that we want? You know, if we get the wrong input, we're going to get the wrong output. That's something extremely important.
Thanks to both of you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate being here.
That was Sylvia Romero-Johnson, Executive Director of the Office of Multilingual and Global Education at Madison Metropolitan Schools, and Salvador Carranza, President of the Latino Education Council, talking about English language learners in Wisconsin. I'd like to take a moment to take you back to high school and the language and literature classes you may have taken back in the day. There's a good chance that at some point during those years you looked at your syllabus and thought, who cares? What does this have to do with my life? Or even, this is so old. Does this really matter today? Well, when it comes to ancient Greek tragedies, our next guest has an answer for you, a resounding yes. Brian Dorries is a theater director who has embraced ancient Greek tragedies as a way to help people confront modern traumas, things like war, incarceration, and death of a loved one. Brian's the founder of a theater company that puts on plays for veterans, prisoners, the elderly. He's the author of a new book called The Theater of War, What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us Today. He joins us now. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Where did you first get this idea to use ancient Greek tragedies to help veterans deal with the trauma of their experiences?
Well, I wasn't the first person in the academic world to make the connection between ancient Greek warfare and ancient Greek drama. Sophocles was a general. The Athenians in the 5th century had been at war for nearly 80 out of 100 years. The audience would have been mostly combat veterans. The actors themselves would have been combat veterans. And many of the plays deal explicitly with topics that those who've been to war intrinsically understand. But I was the first person crazy enough to try to put ancient Greek plays in front of contemporary Marines and soldiers. And in 2008, I got my first audience of 400 Marines in a Hyatt ballroom in San Diego. We performed scenes from Sophocles' plays, and their response changed my life and changed my relationship to ancient Greek tragedy.
Yeah, I want to talk through that scene, Brian. You've persuaded, I think, skeptical, it's fair to say, officers to let this thing happen. You've got a skeptical audience of Marines out there, I think you said, looking at their phones at first in the book. What happened during the show, and what happened after that show that told you you were onto something here?
So we perform only sections of these plays, and we do it as a reading, but it's more like a reading on steroids. Spit is flying, vocal cords are being shredded. We also work with some of the best actors in the field. That first performance, we had Jesse Eisenberg and David Strathairn. And about 45 minutes into the performance, I mean, you could have heard a pin drop, the phones all went away, the audience members, the Marines leaned forward in their seats and they did what in the military is called locking on. They stared at the stage, at their target with this incredible level of attention I'd never seen in the theater before. And when the performance was over, we had scheduled a 45-minute period for just a discussion of what resonated with these ancient Greek war plays with this audience. And the discussion lasted 3.5 hours and had to be cut off at midnight. And each person who spoke quoted lines from Sophocles' plays as if he or she had known the plays their entire life and related those lines to harrowing personal stories that never shared in public, let alone in private, and explicated and illuminated what these ancient Greek plays signify 2,500 years later in this really remarkable way.
Yeah, what is it that these Greek playwrights got right 2,500 years ago, 2.5 millennia, that today's war veterans feel so powerfully, that it speaks to them so powerfully?
Well, the Greeks knew that it wasn't safe or adaptive to cry during combat. You know, we have a lot of professions in our modern world today where we practice a level of clinical detachment that happens in warfare, it happens in hospitals, and rightfully so. You want there to be a hierarchy, you want people to be slightly dispassionate when they're doing something where the stakes are so high, but the Greeks also knew that it wasn't safe and it wasn't healthy to bottle up the emotions, the appropriate emotions one should feel with regard to the witnessing of suffering and death in these high-stakes situations, that there had to be a place and there had to be a time where people were given permission to feel those emotions and express them. And my book argues, and my work argues, that ancient Greek theater was, in fact, that place, the theater of Dionysus, which was in the center of Athens, that highly militarized democracy from which we have borrowed so much, that theater was the very place where people were given permission to feel again what it was appropriate to feel.
When I think veterans and trauma, I think the phrase PTSD leaps to mind, but you say it's more than that. You use the phrase, I think, moral injury, this sense that you've had to have a different moral framework, negative in many ways, positive in the sense of camaraderie of wartime. How do you come back from that and live in a civilian world? Is that what you're trying to tackle here?
Yeah, I mean, moral injury, this is a concept that's recently come up. I mean, PTSD, as many people know, you know, is really only a product of the last 25, 30 years, you know, as a term. So it would be preposterous for me to say that the ancient Greeks were talking about PTSD, because that's really a very modern conception of trauma. But moral injury, this notion, as Jonathan Shea puts it in his work, that the betrayal of what's right in a high-stakes situation in which you often have very little control, an event occurs that upends your moral compass, your sense of right and wrong, that a betrayal happens where you feel you've been devalued or your worldview or your values have been upended. In the high-stakes asymmetrical warfare of the last 14 years, our current conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, it seems the opportunity for moral injury to take place, these types of betrayals of self, betrayal by others, only proliferate with the intensity of this type of warfare. And so these plays speak to deeply human, deeply moral, deeply spiritual issues. They speak to military values that in some ways haven't changed across thousands of years. And these contemporary military audiences respond to them as if they've been written directly for them and with them in mind.
Talking to Brian Dorries, founder of Theater of War, author of a book of the same name, The Theater of War, talking about how he uses ancient Greek drama, ancient tragedies, to help veterans and others deal with the traumatic experiences of their lives. One objection that you encountered from some officers as you went into this, Brian, was the idea that seeing these traumatic plays could re-traumatize. This is something that you shouldn't be confronted with, something similar to your own trauma. How did you respond to that? How did that work out in the performances you've done?
Well, I want to be really respectful. People deal with trauma in many different ways, and there's no one prescribed way of healing. But what the Greeks knew, and what we've been learning from these audiences, is that it's very powerful, it's very validating, it's very healing to come together as a community and not to suffer in isolation, but to acknowledge what you've been through as a group. And so this fear that we'd be re-traumatizing people who've experienced death and loss and threat to their lives and their loved ones, it certainly was something we took very seriously. And we always have mental health professionals present when we perform. But what I see night after night in every audience for whom we perform, and the audiences and the face members of audience members, is a palpable sense of relief when people see their own struggles reflected in a 2,500-year-old story, when they see that they're not alone, not only not alone in their community or across the country and the world, but most important, they're not alone across time. And that is the public health message. I think that's the most healing aspect of what we do.
I want to get into at least one of the stories that you present in these Ajax, one of the, on the Greek side, I believe, in the Trojan War. Sum up his story, the part at least you portrayed for veterans and how they reacted to that.
So Ajax is a story about a decorated Greek warrior, the strongest in the Greek army, who in the ninth year of the Trojan War loses his best friend and Achilles, and slips into a depression. He's devalued, in some ways betrayed by his commanding officers when they pass him over for the award of Achilles' armor, and he flies off into a blind rage and attempts to kill his commanding officers, and ultimately takes his own life in shame against the pleading of his family. You know, I often ask audiences, well, why do you think Sophocles wrote this play? What was he trying to say? What was he trying to do, this general, in a century in which the Athenians saw nearly 80 years of war? The most common response I hear back to Ajax from military audiences, I heard it first on a U.S.-German artillery base, was a young enlisted soldier raised his hand and said, I think Sophocles wrote this play to boost morale. I say, well, what's morale boosting about watching a great warrior come unraveled in this way in the ninth year of the war after losing his best friend? And before I could finish asking the question, the young enlisted soldier shot back, because it's the truth, and because we're all sitting here as a community acknowledging it. It's not being whitewashed. And for me, that was a huge revelation as a civilian, that the stories of these plays depict very grim, very dark stories. Some of the darkest aspects of our humanity manifest on stage. The hope in these stories is not in the plays themselves. It's in the audience that comes together to bear witness to the truth of the story. And for me, it was a major revelation to realize that one could find solace and even hope and joy and camaraderie in facing the darkness together. And the military has taught me that over and over again as we've been touring these performances.
We're talking to Brian Dorries. He's the founder of Theater of War and author of the book, The Theater of War, What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us About Today. He's talking about his work to help people overcome trauma using ancient drama. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a veteran yourself, what has helped you confront, maybe talk about your experiences? Is there a book, a movie, or even a play that powerfully captured what you'd been through? Do you have questions about the work that Brian's doing? What do you think about this idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Brian Dorries, founder of Theater of War, author of the book, The Theater of War, What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us About Today. We're talking about his work to help people overcome trauma using ancient works of drama. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you suffered from some kind of trauma like this? Are you a veteran yourself? What resources, maybe creative resources, have you used to overcome it? What got you talking about it? What do you think about Brian's approach? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We have Tom on the line with us in Wausau. Tom, hi.
Hi. I really like, I'm a veteran with PTSD, and I really like the idea of the moral, the other spin that he put on this. Can you repeat that moral?
Moral injury, I think was the phrase.
Moral injury, yes, that's so spot on, because and he also mentioned worldview and how when things don't match up to your worldview and you see children that should be in school becoming combatants and things like that, it hurts morally, and that really adds to the PTSD from trauma, from any, you know, getting blown up or anything else, but seeing kids or pregnant women that are strapped with bombs.
And Tom, is there anything you think that has helped you? I'm glad, and thank you for being able to talk about it now. Is there something that's helped you talk about it, helped you work with this trauma, talking to other veterans or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And your guest brought up group work. That's very helpful. Individual counseling too, and actually just talking about it, because some of the things that happen that you feel like this shouldn't have never happened, and then you find out that it happened to other people too, and people are accepting of you and willing to listen to you, that helps.
Tom, thank you so much for calling, and good luck as you continue to deal with that trauma. Brian, I imagine you hear stories like this a lot, and a key part of your performances isn't just the performance themselves, but that opportunity to talk, as Tom just was.
Yeah, I mean, the performance for us is really just a catalyst, a pretext for a conversation that wouldn't have happened otherwise, and we value the discussion over the performance. We have wonderful actors. They deliver the material at its most extreme, and in some ways, what they're doing is giving the audience permission to do what the previous caller just did, which is to speak the truth of their experiences. And by going to the furthest extreme, we're not saying to the audience or to anyone that everyone who goes to war comes back with these extreme emotions. We're just saying, you know, if you in any way relate to anything on the spectrum of what we're performing, then you know you're not alone, and it's normal, and let's talk about it. And so if I had one word to define our work, it's permission.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. To another caller now, Charles is with us in Milwaukee. Charles, hi.
Hi, this is a really great topic. When these wars started, growing up in the 70s, I saw what happened to Vietnam vets, and I went from being a truck driver to being a social worker, specifically with the intention of working with Iraq, Afghanistan vets, because I recognized the need. I did that. It's not going to end anytime soon. I mean, the traumas of war are going to continue for a lot of these people. I saw this with Vietnam. I'm too young for World War II. I'm glad you mentioned Jonathan Shea. I would certainly hope you're familiar with Ed Pick. He has done a lot of work with, based in Greek mythology. One of the works he points to is Homer's Odyssey. I mean, there's a reason why it took so many years. Well, it took so many years to get back from I guess Troy or wherever. And with this hopping on a plane and you know being back here, there's less time to process and recover from these injuries. I thank you for your work.
Charles, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, Brian, what did you want to say?
Well, Jonathan Shea, who wrote Achilles in Vietnam, is a MacArthur Award-winning psychiatrist who worked with Vietnam veterans for decades, and he argues that storytelling in the Western world was born from the need to hear and tell the veteran story, that it's not a coincidence the Iliad and the Odyssey are really war stories. And the Odyssey, as your caller just pointed out, is a story of a veteran's 10-year journey home after a 10-year war. And this point that he makes that our veterans now, you know, without any time to process what they've been through, jump on airplanes, and within 24 hours of being on the battlefront or on the home front, really, I think, couldn't be overstated. You know, the very healing mechanisms that were afforded in the ancient world just by the proximity of distance and the ability to take time to process these things are not afforded to our veterans. And so we have to find ways, we have to find tools to give them the space and time, both in private, but I would argue also in public, with citizens around them who haven't been touched by the war, collectively shouldering the burdens they brought back as a community.
Talking to Brian Dorries about his new book, The Theater of War, What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us Today. Back to our callers now with Jim in Fontana. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I'm not a veteran. I am a professional storyteller, though, and I've been interviewing for 30 years all kinds of people. I interviewed a D-Day survivor. I'm interviewing a Vietnam survivor right now, a vet. And with all of our society's denial of what really happens, there's a photographer tried to get a photo published from the road to hell. It was in Iraq, of a Iraqi trying to climb out of his truck, and he was completely burned. And nobody would publish it. It was finally published in The Observer in England. Nobody in America would publish it. You know, we didn't have any pictures taken of the caskets coming in to Delaware. Mm-hmm. And as a storyteller, I also have a certified counselor, too. I've seen the incredible power of just telling your story. It's part of what I do for the last 30 years. And I'm just wondering if, as a culture, partly
because of Mimedian political manipulation. We don't really know really what's going on, and so therefore, you know, what you don't know, you're afraid of. So we can't listen to the stories. We're afraid to listen to the stories. So our veterans come back, and they're so very isolated because of that. Does that make sense in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I would say absolutely. I mean, as you know, I'm sure less than 0.5% of our population has served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, so they are by nature isolated. And I think, and, you know, I would defer to you also as a storyteller, but for me, you know, just as a normal citizen, I didn't know anyone in the military when I started this project. If I let myself feel what it would be appropriate to feel, simply opening the newspaper or walking, in my case, in New York City to the subway every day, I would be overwhelmed with emotion. And I think we as human beings build up all kinds of protective walls, even if we don't work in these intense professions, not to feel what it would be appropriate to feel if we really, you know, let our humanity respond to the stories that we hear. And there's something about live storytelling as a medium of being in the presence of, in the room with someone who's portraying the struggle or the suffering of another individual that breaks through those defensive walls and mediates and creates an opportunity for people to actually feel something that would be appropriate. Now, it works for veterans who've been maybe disconnected from their feelings for all kinds of reasons, but we also do performances for the general public. We'll be at Guggenheim Museum tomorrow night and for a mostly civilian audience. And, you know, the idea is that we need story. We desperately need live storytelling to sit in a room together to acknowledge our shared humanity. It's not magic. I don't think it heals people. It's not the fix. It's just a door, and people can walk through it. And without that medium, I don't know how people find their way. I think it's a crucial thing that we as humans do and maybe as a culture have lost touch with because of how isolated and mediated we are by our technology.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Brian Dorries, founder of Theater of War. He's author of the new book, The Theater of War, What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us Today. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow morning after 6, how not to bug your coworkers. Joy's guest teaches us the finer point of etiquette at the workplace. That's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Well, it's Halloween week now. Today, apparently, I find, is National Pumpkin Day, a day to celebrate, maybe carve, and maybe even cook stuff with pumpkins. I've turned into a big fan of cooking with pumpkins just over the last few years. Yesterday, I made a pumpkin soup, some leeks, chard, carrots, and garlic. Came out pretty good. Last week, I did pumpkin pancakes or patties or something. They didn't hold together very well, but they tasted really good. For decoration at my house, some cool-looking pumpkins out front. We didn't carve them, though. The kids, not interested. Missed a creative opportunity there. On the upside, it'll take the squirrels longer to eat through them. But maybe you carved some pumpkins. And if so, we want you to share the fun with us. Share your jack-o'-lantern picture with Central Time. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page. Producer Amanda Magnus has a picture of her friendly-looking creation over there. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Again, share your pumpkin art creation at the Central Time Facebook page or on Twitter at Central Time WPR. And of course, be courteous, no smashing of pumpkins this week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.